Right, so I'm from just down the street with the Structural Genomics Consortium, which I'll tell you about today, operates out of the Banting Institute building, one of the older, if not older, CFT building, in some renovated space there. And so it's a large international project whose goal is to annotate important human proteins in terms of three-dimensional structure. And it feeds off the Human Genome Project. And I'm going to tell you about this, but before, I want to give a little bit of background about structural biology, or the structural sciences in general, and how this fits into sort of the international landscape in this field of research. So structural biology, or using the three-dimensional structure at atomic level resolution of biological macromolecules, has many complexities, and many people use structural biology for many different purposes. What I would call a traditional structural biology lab, there are many of which are in Toronto, use either X-ray crystallography or NMR spectroscopy to understand at the atomic level the three-dimensional shape of proteins, and use that shape to understand their biochemical and chemical properties, is usually driven by the biology. We rely on biologists, cell biologists, physiologists to tell us what proteins are important to work on. And usually it's done in a case-by-case system, a given protein. The goal is to solve its three-dimensional structure and look at its interaction with other molecules that it interacts with, and understand how it carries out its biochemical and physiological function, focusing on one protein at a time. Detailed analysis, structure, function, kinetics, et cetera. It could be from any organism, and it's often focused increasingly on macromolecular complexes. And the three-dimensional structure of proteins that can be targeted for therapeutically is, of course, the subject of study within pharmaceutical companies and also in academia. But here the interest could be anything from just understanding basic biology within pharma, biotech, and also many labs, academic labs. The goal is to understand the three-dimensional structure of a protein so that you can design an inhibitor or a small molecule that could become a drug in order to affect a physiological pathway. And so here, again, you want to determine the 3D structure of a given single target at all costs, and it's driven in this case by chemistry. One does iterative design with medicinal chemists to design a molecule that both fits nicely and tightly into a binding pocket, but also has desirable properties in terms of low toxicity, absorption into the system, and long lifetime in the body, for example. And this is always focused on human proteins and proteins of human pathogens. Now, in the post-genomic era, since the human genome and genomes of many pathogens have been discovered, and even model organisms for which, you know, that don't infect humans and wouldn't be useful for drug discovery, but are useful for understanding basic biological processes, basic science perspective, we can now start to think about applying structural biology on a genome-wide scale, and to look at populations of proteins, make these proteins in parallel, determine their three-dimensional structure. And the rationale for doing this is because in most genomes, the majority of the proteins the proteins which are coded by the genes rarely are they completely characterized. Most of them, the three-dimensional structure is not known for, and many of them, we know absolutely nothing about them. And so the three-dimensional structure can inform you about what this protein may do, and even if you know what it's if it's a certain enzyme, the 3D structure is important for understanding how it carries out that activity. Okay, so the structures can be used as a tool for functional assessment. It includes Again, on characterized proteins, we do things in a rapid parallel procedure. However, this field is still not high throughput in the sense that microarray analyses, proteomics analyses, and even especially genome sequencing is these days. We're still talking about tens of structures at a time and working on at most hundreds of proteins at a time, and maybe get into the thousands over several years. But so the numbers are still small compared to many other omics technologies, but it's still one or two orders of magnitude higher than traditional structural biology. Okay? And we like to think of some of this as hypothesis-generating science. So you start with many genes which are uncharacterized. You can see now what it looks like, which generates a hypothesis that biologists, biochemists, can now use for further study. And there's a lot of research in this area going around the world. They're usually large collaborative consortium-like projects. I'll just highlight a few. The United States National Institutes of Health has about 13 centers now working on an initiative they call the Protein Structure Initiative. And there the goal is each of the different centers has a different emphasis on the type of proteins they're working on, but they have the goal of solving about 300, 400 protein structures a year in the current phase. Okay. In Europe, there are several initiatives going on. Some are pan-Europe, some are in individual countries. The Japanese have a very, very large project headed at the institute called RIKEN, but really much a collaboration amongst most of the structural biologist in Japan. And Canada has a pretty strong presence in this area as well. We meaning Aled Edwards and myself, have a laboratory in Toronto that's affiliated with two of these NIH centers. And Montreal and Kingston have a Genome Canada funded project that also does this type of research. And then in addition to that, in Toronto, in Oxford, UK, and in Karolinska, oops, one line missing, and this might be an old slide, yeah, old slide. We have a third site now at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. There's a star, there should be a line going there. Three sites for the SGC, which focuses on human proteins. And so most of the proteins in the NIH project are microbial or model organisms, from model organisms. Same for this project. The European projects are a mixture of human and other proteins, and the RIKEN project is a lot of mouse proteins and model organisms, and some human as well. But the SGC's focus is almost entirely on human proteins, and human proteins of therapeutic interest. Okay. So again, just the different projects have different goals. The NIH and to some extent the Japanese project have a goal of filling out protein fold space. And so what that means is there's a public database of all the three-dimensional protein structures that have been solved, the PDB, protein database, and based on sequence similarity, so the protein is a chain of amino acids, which in the sequence of which determines how it's going to fold up in a three-dimensional space. And if the sequence is similar to another protein for which the structure has been solved, you can create what's called a homology model. You can model what the structure will look like. And what these projects focus on is determining a representative structure of every unique family of sequences, so that one could model all proteins in the universe. And so they're systematically trying to go through those families. The SGC, some of the European projects, are some of them focus on important proteins. Proteins are known to be drug targets, et cetera. And the problem is, so much of the genome is uncharacterized and unknown. We don't really know what all the real drug targets are. And so the SGC, I'll show you, we take a broader approach. We focus on a known drug target, but then all the similar types of proteins that could be related to it. Another strategy is to just sort of scan genomes, make whatever proteins one can, see what the structures look like, and rely on the new structural information to inform about protein function. Put all the information in the database. You might not be able to understand what it means now, but at some point in time, there will be additional data to go with that, and the structure will be available for analysis. Pharmaceutical industry, again, is interested in the technologies that are developed in here because everyone's interested in rapid strategies for rapid protein production, crystallization for crystallography, and the ability to solve protein structures with small molecules. And so everyone's interested in the technologies that are developed. So back to the SGC. It's a consortium of funders, and the funders are listed on the first slide, public and private partners, and the aim is to solve three-dimensional structures, proteins of relevance to human health, and put the coordinates, the atomic coordinates, in the public domain so that anybody who wants to design a drug can use that information and are free to use that information. The idea is not to have these important structures tied up or kept secret within pharmaceutical companies, for example, so that people are inhibited from drug design. Okay? And the idea is that the three-dimensional structure at high enough resolution is the basis for structure-based drug design and will enable drug discovery. Okay? So the principles are that it's organized as a charity. It's incorporated as a company, but the company is a charity in the UK. And the original concept was developed by the Wellcome Trust in the UK, and it followed off. Wellcome Trust funded the sequencing of about a third of the human genome, and then they followed on that project with their next biggest project was this SNP consortium, whose goal was to map all the different variations in genes and proteins that exist in humans, and that's still ongoing and becoming very successful. And then their next biggest project was the SGC. And Canadian granting agencies have joined in to that, as well as GlaxoSmithKline, pharmaceutical company, and Swedish granting agencies. So everything goes in the public domain without restriction, and it's a milestone-driven project, which for us academics is a little bit of a different way of doing science. We are committed to solve structures 115 and 230 in years 1, 2, and 3. And at the time, those were very aggressive goals, but we have been able to meet them, as I'll show you. So the approach that we're taking is a gene family approach. And because the purpose is for structure-based drug design, we're always mindful of the field that you could call chemical biology, in other words, small molecules, especially synthetic molecules that will interact with the proteins of interest. And because a gene family, for example, a family of enzymes that carries out a similar type of reaction, transfers a phosphate group onto a substrate, but the substrates may differ between the various members of the family, that's a gene family. Kinases, for example, protein kinases are one. And because they carry out a similar type of chemistry, similar types of small molecules, that are related to the substrates and cofactors can fit into the active site. And so the types of questions we want to ask are how similar and different are the active sites in the three-dimensional structures and sizes? How similar or different are the substrate binding profiles? What spectrum of molecules will they bind to? And here, visualizing the structure can help, and using experimental and virtual screening technologies. So you have you can do computationally, you can take the three-dimensional structure and dock small molecules and using potential functions they're not that accurate, but for estimating the energetic interactions between small molecules and proteins, you can try to predict which small molecules will interact. Of course, doing it experimentally is also an important method. Can we identify substrates for these so-called orphan members of the families, members of a gene family that are less well characterized and the substrates are not known? And can we identify new substrates, inhibitors or compounds that bind to already well characterized proteins? And again, structure and screening technologies are useful here. Okay. So again, it's three sites. I run the Toronto site. My colleague Alan Edwards is the overall director of the whole project, and we have a mirror site of about the same size at University of Oxford and a smaller site at the Karolinska Institute. So what types of targets, proteins, or genes are we working on? This is a figure from a review on drug discovery. The human genome has on the order of 30,000 genes in it. The proteins that are real drug targets are at the intersection of the so-called proteins that are disease-modifying, proteins in which if you can modify their activity or modulate their activity, you will affect a physiological pathway. And the intersection of that set of proteins with those proteins that are druggable. And druggable means the protein has a groove or a pocket in it in which a small molecule will fit and bind to. And the intersection, though these are guesses, I don't know if you can read it, guesses about numbers of targets or proteins that would fit in these categories, maybe 3,000 disease-modifying genes, about 3,000 druggable genes, and maybe 600 to 1,500, but I think these are largely guesses. Okay. And so we're working on, so the current set of targets are pretty much those have been worked on for the last 10 or 20 years. They include proteases, ion channels, cytochrome P450 enzymes, cation channels, a variety of other proteins, G protein-coupled receptors, serine, threonine, tyrosine kinases, more proteases, nuclear hormone receptors, and more proteases. Potentially, additional proteins could be added to this. And after the genome was sequenced, we realized there's a lot more serine, threonine kinases, for example, than were previous thought. So this, the proportions here enlarge, and you can see that this sort of uncharacterized section also enlarges. And so the FGC is targeting most of these areas. Okay, and the breakdown is as follows. I'll just focus on Toronto areas in case anyone's interested. To collaborate, we are highly collaborative. It's a milestone-driven project. We're really focused on getting the structures one after the other, and are highly interested in collaborating with outside entities on any technologies or analyses that can be done with these structures. So in Toronto, we work on proteases, ubiquitination pathway, and a collection of proteins involved implicated in diabetes. Serrano de Paganon leads a group in this area. Non-protein kinases, GTPases and ATPases. Hee-Won Park leads a group in this area. Metabolism and chromatin remodeling proteins. Alex Plotnikov leads a team that works on the P450s, methyl transferases, sulfyl transferases, acetyl transferases, nuclear receptors, and phosphodiesterases. And we also have a fourth program that focuses on malaria-related proteins, so proteins from the parasite Plasmodium falciparum and other related epicomplexan organisms. And to date, we've solved 215 structures and are slightly ahead of schedule. So again, the strategy is to work on gene families. The reason is that you can leverage knowledge of one app, of a given assay or biochemistry that an enzyme may carry out to study the rest of the protein family. Leverage knowledge of proteins' biophysical behavior, often a given family of proteins that have similar structures and carry out similar chemistry will behave similarly biophysically, and the biophysical behavior of proteins is a great challenge to us because we need to make lots of protein. It has to be soluble, it has to be stable in order to generate crystals, and that's actually one of our biggest challenges. And then we want to compare the details of the active sites of these proteins across the whole family. So if you want to design a drug to one member of the family and want to specifically target a pathway that it participates in, you want that drug to be specific to one protein and not bind to structurally related active sites in the other members of the family. So you really need to know what all of them look like. And so we use small molecules in a lot of different ways. We use them to stabilize our proteins for crystallization by having small molecule substrate cofactor inhibitors in the active sites and the structures. We can understand about the catalytic mechanisms, understand issues related to selectivity and specificity, and to annotate orphan members of gene families. So the process, what we spend a lot of time in the lab doing is selecting the proteins we want to work on, identify the catalytically active domains of those proteins, use recombinant DNA technology to express the proteins in E. coli. So we have a molecular biology group that does that. We have actually four protein groups, these three plus malaria group, that makes the proteins, purifies them, tries to crystallize them. They're facilitated by a group that does biophysical analysis, and I'll explain some of the techniques we use here. We also have an engineering group and a bioinformatics group that helps keep track of the data, helps with some instrumentation to make things go in parallel and a little bit faster. And then a protein crystallography lab that helps collect diffraction data and determine the three-dimensional structures. Okay. And again, that all the information goes, once the structure is solved, all the information goes in the public database, the protein data bank. And our website, we have a lot of information on the website. We put an image of each structure with a description of why it's important and what the structure means, and with a link to the molecular coordinates, atomic coordinates in the PDB. Detailed materials and methods is available on how to make, express, purify, crystallize the protein. So the scientists and pharmaceutical companies find this very useful, because even if we solve the structure and put it in the data bank, what they need to do in order to design a drug is solve that protein with many, many small molecules to design this iterative design process. So they need to be able to make it themselves. And so we make that information available. And some of the technologies we develop are also on the website. So I'm going to breeze through some of the gene families that we've made significant progress on, and then in the latter half of the talk, I'll talk about some specific examples. So this part will be rather quick and superficial. Hee-Won Park's group works on the ARF and RAB subfamily of GTPases, so they convert GTP to GDP, guanidine triphosphate to guanidine diphosphate, and that's coupled with interaction with at a membrane surface and is signaling process in a number of physiological processes. And for the ARF family, so you can see the proteins all look very similar. These guys have GTP, these have GDP. In the ARF family, however, the presence of this red helix, which is thought to insert into the membrane of a cell and start the signaling process. In the presence of this helix, these loops, these activation loops, are always in the GDP bound conformation, even if there's a GTP bound to the protein. And if you don't have the helix, it's always in the GTP conformation, even if GDP is bound. And this is counter to the existing dogma in the field, which said first you have to bind GTP, and then the helix flips out and goes in the membrane, and then it gets hydrolyzed. But we find that it's not dependent on the ligand. It's dependent on where the helix is and whether the helix is in the membrane or not. A lot of structures from apicomplexan parasites, and in 2005, 60% of the structures in the public database from these types of organisms were contributed by the SGC. Peptidoprolyl isomerases are a class of proteins that catalyze the flipping of a transpeptide, a cis-peptide bond to trans conformation. That's shown here. And it's a small family, but they all have this conserved domain. And cyclophilin is a drug that was originally cyclosporin A was a drug that was originally identified to bind to cyclophilin A, and we're targeting all the members of this family. We saw four of them so far, and there's a whole series of drugs similar to cyclosporin that are used, are very important drugs in immunosuppression, and also now are useful in HIV therapy. And what we find is that several, so this is a phylogenetic tree of this family, and you can see that the ones we've solved are from all over the tree. Even though they're very different sequence-wise, three of the four bind to this drug. So the original, I mean, the doctors who administer this drug all think it's hitting cyclophilin, but in fact, we know that if the drug appears in a cell that expresses some of these other, it's also targeting these. And it does have a lot of side effects, so maybe some of the side effects are related to these so-called off-target effects. In Oxford, they're working on the human short-chain dehydrogenase family, implicating a lot of different disease processes. These are oxidoreductases, and 69 of them overall, and they've solved a lot of them so far. Histone-modifying enzymes, so these are enzymes that are, participate in the control of gene expression, help turn genes on and off, and they've solved a number of those structures here in Toronto. The ubiquitination system. So ubiquitin is a small protein. It's about 76 amino acids. A small protein that gets added on to other proteins, and it acts as a signal. It targets them to be degraded. So it's used to control the level of proteins in the cell. Targets them to the membrane to do certain things and vesicle formation. It's a signal on the genome when it gets put on the histones to activate or repress genes. And there's a whole network of enzymes here that take, E1 takes the ubiquitin, puts it on an E2 protein, the E2 then transfers it with an E3 to the target, and you get the target's modified, and then you have enzymes that take the ubiquitin off. And there's actually 31 different ubiquitin-like molecules 30 in the human genome, 36 enzymes that transfer the ubiquitin to an E3, and there's 54 that take ubiquitins off. And Serrano DePaganon's group is making progress in defining those structures. Human serine threonine kinases are a very important class of proteins, especially in cancer therapy. A number of these, TIM1 especially, and FAK kinases are important targets in cancer therapy, and a number of these structures have been solved with inhibitors, clinically important inhibitors, in their active sites. Tyrosine. Here are some examples again of the three-dimensional structures with small molecule inhibitors. We screen them internally, actually phosphatases. So these are the enzymes that take the phosphate off. I have a collaboration with a group in Berlin that screens for small molecules that can inhibit this, and we've solved some structures with those in the active site. Mostly we work on individual proteins, but in some cases we've solved protein complexes. This is an important signaling complex in cancer, solved in Oxford, and Serrano's group here in Toronto has solved this structure. So this is a protein, this is one of the ubiquitin-specific proteases, takes ubiquitin off molecules. It interacts with this protein here, as well as many other proteins, and this shows a conserved pocket on this protein that binds to this particular sequence of USB8. And by now being able to visualize this and know exactly which, it was known before that these two interacted, but it wasn't known where. Now that we know the exact bit that interacts with the green protein here, we can now predict, we can search the genome for this sequences that would fit in here. It turns out there's not very many of them, and there's a subset that are other proteins that are known to bind to this, and so we can predict the exact motif that's going to This is a one-letter code for amino acids. So the motif that will bind to this protein. We have a pilot project in membrane proteins. Membrane proteins are an order of magnitude harder than non-membrane human proteins because they exist in a lipid bilayer, which will go along here. So these are all hydrophobic residues that lie in the lipid, and then you have the intracellular bit that in these cases, these are ion channels. And so modulations here open up or close the ion channel and modulate allowing ions in and out of the cell. This is another signaling proteins. Most of them were solved at Oxford. One was solved elsewhere, and the rest was solved at Oxford. They all bind phosphopeptides, and we now know, so these are all the members that are in the human genome. We've got structures for them all, and we can now understand how they interact with the peptides that they bind to. Okay. So now I'll spend a little bit of time on some more specifics. So in Toronto, the Plotnikov group is working on methyltransferases. Many of these are involved in metabolizing drugs and xenobiotics, and these are the so-called small molecule methyltransferases. Put a methyl on a small molecule, it's now a different chemical entity and behaves differently. And one of these, thiopurine methyltransferase, is very important in the treatment of cancer, particularly childhood leukemia, ALL leukemia, because thiopurine-based drugs are used to treat this disease. And the treatment regime relies on the fact that TPMT converts 6-mercaptopurine into methyl 6-mercaptopurine. And if the balance of these is out of whack, then it can become very toxic. And there's three alleles, or three variant sequences of this gene that occur in a small percentage of the human population, but it's just three single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, can account for 95% of the observed cases where the balance of these therapeutics gets out of balance because of TPMT deficiency. Okay, and if you have one of these SNPs, you can't be treated with these drugs because it's very toxic. Okay, and if that's the main therapy for this disease, then you're in trouble. So we wanted to so we saw the structure of this protein, and this is the substrate for which the methyl group is taken. And in yellow here are the residues of the three SNPs. And you can see, so the active site's over here with the S-adenosylmethionine, and there's a SNP here, back there, and down here. Okay, so they're not at the active site. They're elsewhere in the protein. So how can they, how are they affecting the activity of the protein? So we did some biophysical analysis, and this is a plot of temperature versus, monitoring light scattering as the protein becomes unstable and aggregates. But the wild type protein is shown here. It has a midpoint of decomposition or melting around 50 some degrees, and you see that two of the mutants melt at lower temperatures, or they're less thermally stable. And if you do an enzymatic assay, this is the total activity of the wild type protein, and these two mutants also have much lower activity. So although these mutations in the protein are not in the active site, they're not affecting directly the residues involved in catalysis, because the proteins are destabilized overall, maybe the proportion of the protein is unfolded and not active, it has low overall activity, and so the precursor molecule builds up in the system and becomes toxic. And so there's a lot more cases where we want to understand how small molecules will interact with the proteins we're looking at. And so we've used are interested in a technology that takes advantage of the fact that we're using purified proteins. Most drug discovery efforts make use of high throughput screening assays where you have some kind of activity-based assay, conversion of the using the enzyme to convert something that gives a fluorescent signal, for example, and you monitor fluorescence. And you can do this in cells, and you can do it with purified protein, but you need to have a specific assay for every different protein, and that becomes very laborious and is just not feasible for us to do. But instead, we want to take advantage of the fact that we have a lot of purified proteins. And so we would like a generic method that would be amenable to all proteins. And ideally, the results could also be useful in helping us crystallize protein. We don't need high throughput. We just need medium throughput because we kind of know that we know the chemical class that our enzymes belong to, so we can make focused libraries of compounds that we know are likely to bind. We would like to do it in a multi-well format in a fast and simple way, and ideally it should be inexpensive and low operating costs. So there's three ways to do this. Whoa, where am I? Okay, so here's a way you can do it. Just like the slide I showed you previously, if you plot temperature along here and some signal along here, you can monitor the thermal stability of a protein. And so as you heat up a protein, it there's an equilibrium between its native conformation and an unfolded conformation. And the denatured conformation can either aggregate, can either aggregate and scatter light as it starts to precipitate in your whatever you're measuring, and it can scatter light. Or the process between native and denatured, the hydrophobic interior of the protein starts to be exposed, and a dye that interacts with the hydrophobic core, if the dye has a fluorescent properties, the fluorescence will change as it binds, and you can monitor that. Okay, and then if you add a ligand that stabilizes this protein to the system, then you're going to shift the equilibrium over here, and you can measure that this way. So in the presence of a ligand, you get the red curve with the midpoint, melting midpoint, that's shifted to a higher temperature than the native apoprotein. And this temperature midpoint of melting, the TM, is roughly related to the binding affinity of the small molecule for the protein. So we use this. So we have two platforms for doing this. These two are just two different instruments that are fluorescence-based plate readers. This is an simple RT-PCR machine. This is another fluorescent plate reader. This one's a little bit better because it goes to higher temperature, and sometimes proteins can be quite stable and won't melt at all. Another method we use is this one that was developed at a local biotech company. This uses light scattering, so it detects the aggregation of the protein. Okay, so they're cheap, they're medium throughput, either 384 well or 96 well plates. Works for most proteins, but not all proteins. Some proteins have fluorescent properties, or the compounds have fluorescent properties, so they don't work with these two. And some proteins have melt at too high a temperature or are too unstable to be able to use for these methods. All right. So how do we use it? We can that slide just shouldn't be there. Okay. So this is just a picture of the plate for the scattering method. You just shine light down. You take an image of overall image of the plate, and you look at the scatter, and amount of scattered light, you can plot it versus the intensity of the scatter versus temperature, and then we've developed software that fits just this transition part to a curve, and you can do it in multi-well format, and then this shows the change in in the presence of a ligand. And so we only worry about the midpoint of transition. We don't worry about the shape of the curve. That it's going down here because the protein's really precipitating and it's falling out of solution, and so the solution is now becoming clearer here because it's all at the bottom of the well. So you want to catch the midpoint of this transition here. Okay. So there's two applications for this type of screen: a generic set of conditions that can help improve the stability of the protein, because stability and aggregation and precipitation is often a problem with proteins we work on, and we can screen for the presence of ligands that presumably bind to specific active sites in the protein. So these are just some quick examples of how we use it just in order to get the structure. So here's a protein that binds ATP, and we knew it bound to ATP, but they initially set up a screen at 5 millimolar ATP and got these little grainy crystals, which aren't good enough. Do a titration, you found that 5 millimolar is not, we haven't saturated, we haven't, not all the sites are occupied with ATP, so they use a much higher concentration. You get nice protein crystals, which allow us to solve the structure. Here's another example again, lousy crystals. You get a very large temperature shift here in the presence of magnesium chloride. Now you get these nice long rod crystals, which diffract X-rays to 2.2 angstroms, allowing the structure. Okay, so the last 5 to 10 minutes, I'm going to review how we've married the use of three-dimensional structure information with the chemical biology or the chemical screening information to try to understand a complete gene family. And that family is the human cytosol sulfotransferases. The reaction that it catalyzes is using this substrate, phosphoadenosine 5-phosphosulfate, or PAP. So here's the molecule. It's got the sulfur group right here. Gets transferred on to a hydroxyl group of a substrate. And the substrates are steroids, xenobiotics, drugs, and naturally and synthetically occurring compounds, including carcinogens. And in the human genome, there's about 11 of these. The phylogenetic tree showing how related the sequences are, the primary sequences are to one another. And here's the structures of them all. And there's one more left, 1C3, that we just recently solved. Okay. And so they, as with most gene families, they have differential distribution in different tissues overlapping. Okay, a lot are in the liver because they metabolize xenobiotics, and they metabolize a variety of different types of molecules, phenols, hormones, etc. And some of them are uncharacterized on them. So what do the three-dimensional structures tell us? What I'm showing here is that the existing structures, we've solved about half of them, and other groups have solved about the other half of them. And some are APO structures, so without any ligand in it. Some are with the product of the cofactor PAP, and some are ternary complexes or complexes with substrates. And what we observe is a sequential ordering, progressive ordering of the structures as cofactor and then substrate bound. So the three APO structures here, you can see that there's these dotted lines show a lot of loops for which there's missing electron density. Electron density is how you observe the actual protein in an X-ray diffraction experiment. So the X-rays around the atoms diffract, the electrons around the atoms diffract the X-rays, and you get an electron density map. And so if you can't see the electron density for these bits, it means they're disordered and they've been moving around and they haven't diffracted coherently. So these guys, these structures have much less order, especially in the colored bits, the orange and what's that, cyan and purple, magenta. Okay, this set of structures has the PAP molecule in it, shown here. Okay, and you can see that in the presence of PAP, you get more ordering of this green helix, which forms part of the binding site, especially this little one right here, and this magenta loop firms up here. Okay, it's missing from this one, but it's present in these two. And this magenta loop, especially this region right here in green, if you can see it, also forms part of the substrate binding site. The substrate binds in here. So the next series shows ternary complexes where you have both PAPs, or PAPs, and a substrate. So there's a substrate binding pocket, and as the cofactor binds this magenta loop, sorry, what I'm showing here is just the backbone trace of the polypeptide chain. In reality, all the space in between these squigglies is filled in with atoms, but we're just showing the trace of the chain for clarity, otherwise you couldn't see anything. So this chain is firmed up, and you can see how it now starts to form the active site. The side chains that come off of here are what interacts with the substrate. And then we've observed a couple unusual situations. Here, for example, there's two substrate molecules in the binding site. This enzyme class is known to suffer from, at high concentrations of substrate, substrate-mediated inhibition. So here there's two substrates in the binding site, and this loop is in a different conformation. In fact, this bit is flipped out here, and part of the cofactor binding site is now out of the plane over here. And so presumably it can't bind cofactor and therefore can't carry out the reaction. Okay. And we can compare the local structural similarities in the binding sites to the sequence similarities. And the previous phylogenetic tree that I showed you groups them according to the twos and ones and the twos and the A's and the B's and the C's. But here we see that if you look at just the local substrate binding site, that these two, which are more distant related, 4A and 1A, actually cluster together. So there's something similar about their binding site. The problem is we still can't predict from the 3D structure what substrates they're going to bind to. You need more data, more information. So what we've done is from the literature compiled a set of 90 compounds that are known or related compounds to known substrates and inhibitors and xenobiotics that are metabolized by sulfotransferases. And for each one of the proteins, this plot now shows each bar on here, each point along here is a different compound, and this is the temperature difference at which it melts, either with or without the compound. So a high bar means, in this case, there's about a 7-degree stabilization between stabilization in the protein and the presence of this compound reversible. Okay, and what you can see is each protein has a very different chemical fingerprint. It binds a different spectrum of small molecules. So these active sites are distinct. Some of them bind the same protein. This is the cofactor, for example. They all bind cofactor, but other compounds are unique. And this is the rest of them. You notice that one of them, this orthomember, salt 4A1, doesn't bind a cofactor. And that was interesting. And so here's the other thing the structures showed, and what's known biochemically, is that the mechanism is an ordered series in which it's known that the cofactor binds first, and as we showed you from the structures, cofactor binds, and then that allows the substrate then to bind. And so if we compare the binding profile, the chemical fingerprint of the APO protein with that in the presence of the cofactor, again, you can see that the profiles are very different. They don't bind very many of the same compounds. And the compounds that are the same are usually some kind of inhibitor. Okay. And so for this protein, this is salt 1C3, which was uncharacterized. We took all the proteins that bound in the presence and absence of PAP and did assays on them, and this is the activity. And you see that for the proteins, the compounds in red are those that are active. And even though the protein will bind to epinephrine and norepinephrine, for example, only these phenol-like compounds are actually react or are actually sulfonated. So these are the real substrates, yet other small physiologically relevant small molecules can bind to the protein. So this leads to the hypothesis that the milieu and relative concentrations of all these biologically active small molecules it's actually an interesting modeling exercise. If you knew what all the relative concentrations were, how could you, what would be the reactivity towards these, and how, and would these other compounds inhibit activity, and is that a sort of regulatory process would that set up? So we're now in the process of seeing how well some of these other compounds will inhibit reactivity to these confirmed substrates, and that work is in progress. And now back to these two proteins. 1A3 is well characterized, and it binds to epinephrine and dopamine, which are two related hormones in the brain, very important signaling in the brain. And SALT4A1 binds norepinephrine and epinephrine, also chemically related. Okay, both of these are expressed in the brain. So this makes sense. However, this 4A1 was the protein that didn't bind to the cofactor, so, and is not reactive in our assays, and our 3D structures explain why. So this shows in green is an active protein which has a tryptophan. This is showing the active site where the PAPS molecule binds. This is PAPS, okay? And normally this tryptophan interacts with the PAPS and helps hold it into place there, but in the yellow molecule, 4A1, tryptophan is substituted for leucine, and leucine is shown here, and this is too close. These can't coexist at the same time. So the presence of these atoms prevents the cofactor from binding. It means it doesn't have enzymatic activity, yet it binds things like norepinephrine and epinephrine. So what we think, and it's expressed in the brain, so we think this molecule may have devolved from the enzyme class, started as, you know, evolved to not be an enzyme, but to maybe sequester or compete for these types of small molecules. And that's all I have to say, except to thank the group of people who worked on the sulfyl transferases. The team was led by Alex Plotnikov and Patricia Pan, made a lot of proteins. These are the folks who did the analyses. And the biophysics group did a lot of the screening, structures dissolved in the crystallography group. And Rathi Najmanovich from Janet Thornton's group at the EBI helped with some of the analysis of the proteins. And this is the group down the street at the Banting Building that does the Toronto-based research. Happy to answer any questions.